The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have made it to the start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. And thank you for tuning in. Great show planned for you today, and we're excited, and I hope you are as well. So let me jump into the announcements. For those of you that want to give our guest a call today, Michael Listener, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring. And we'll bring you up on air at just as quickly as we can. And I can hold you over the break if applicable. And we also answer the phone while we're on break. So if you do want to give us a call, don't let the break interfere with your calling plan. If you're not interested in giving us a call for one reason or another, feel free to email us, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, thespaceshow.com, so do check out our rather detailed website newsletter, and it's you'll see it over on the right side of our homepage, thespaceshow.com, and it's uploaded usually right after the Sunday show, or at least no later than Sunday evening. It has all of the details for the week's programming, and if you just scroll down a little bit on the website newsletter, you'll see all of the programs that we have planned for coming attractions, and we are now building out shows for the remainder of 2016. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or easily and very quickly download the shows if you do have a high-speed internet connection. The menu in the upper part of the homepage has a couple of items of interest. Number one, under the support menu, is our LogoWare store, where you can get Space Show t-shirts and coffee mugs and things like that. And in addition, there is a button called Listen Live. And if you want to know how to listen to the Space Show, or you want to give those instructions to a friend, this is where you would direct them to, or do a copy and paste job and just send them those instructions. There's other items of interest that you might want to visit, other links and other bits of information. So do check out that upper left menu. And then on the far right, we have recent shows, and then if you scroll down, there's upcoming shows. And as soon as a program hits upcoming shows, remember that is our blog, so you can start posting on it. And if those posts are made before or during a live show, I will get them, and I can ask our guests those questions. After the show, they're just regular blog archive blog comments. And, of course, we have the 501c3 Support the Space Show buttons. So our parent company, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, is a 501c3 nonprofit and California Public Benefit Corporation. We bring you these programs because many of you do financially contribute to the Space Show. Remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. Do visit our nonprofit website, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Or you can get the information, the PayPal links, and the Amazon information for Amazon supportive programs off of both websites. And again, Amazon has a big link on the homepage as well. So do check it all out. And then the other thing I want to point out is that we are copyrighted and trademarked, and you're free to share our programming with others, but don't do anything commercial with the programs. Don't edit them and then put things up on YouTube or even your own personal website, for that matter. And then written transcripts are not permitted. And we thank you for following these simple rules. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of each website page and OneGiantLeapFoundation.org page. So do read it when you have time, and your questions are welcome. Just email them to me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Podcasting is through gigadial.net. We thank Andrew for that. And we're in iTunes and other places on the net. So if you do have any podcasting questions, email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have sponsors. You'll see their banner ads going across our homepage. And the first segment of today's program, we have two sponsors, Orbital ATK. They are a global leader in aerospace and defense technology and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then Integrated Space Analytics has the Integrated Space Plan. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Visit their website, thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And if you go there, they have discussions, updates, ways to be interactive and participate with them. You can also order your own full color size of the poster for the space plan. And it's an inspiring tool, so it makes a great gift or something that you would want to hang in your office. Again, visit thespaceplan.com. And that brings me to our program today, and it's always a great pleasure and honor to bring Michael Listener back to the Space Show. So Michael is a well-known, highly regarded space attorney, and he is the founder and principal of Space Law and Policy Solutions, which is a think tank and consultation firm that concentrates on legal and policy matters relating to outer space security industry and development. He holds a BS degree in computer information systems from Franklin Pierce University. He has his JD or law degree from Regent University, and he is a member of the New Hampshire Bar. And he has a fabulous, and I mean first-class fabulous, newsletter that he has started writing and that you can subscribe to. Michael, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thanks, David. It's always a pleasure to be here on the Space Show and having this chat with your listeners.
So what is the latest for your Precis newsletter? Because that really is really a cool newsletter.
Well, I'm going to kill that label of newsletter. It's not, and I thought about this over the weekend. It's really not a newsletter because I don't want to be shoehorned thinking this is, you know, I'm trying to become a member of the media, because I'm not. If I had to call it anything, given, you know, the current issue that I'm working on that will be released on Friday is going to be almost 30 pages, definitely isn't ascribed as a newsletter. I call it a briefing letter because it basically I go through and I look at what I think are the important issues that have happened in the past 3 months, and I analyze them, and I basically write what I think, you know, analyze them and give my thoughts and opinions on it. So it really isn't, it's very unbiased, and it's really hard objective analysis. So I call it a briefing letter because it's intended for people, for subscribers to look at, to get a clear picture of what I think, what is going on in, what's important in the space law and policy area, and what I think of it to an extent. If anything, I wouldn't call it a newsletter. I would definitely call it a briefing letter. And I kind of made that change on my website the other day, too, just so people can be informed.
What is new in space policy and law since you were last on the guest? Are things moving in your area, or are they more centered on Musk and his Mars plans, Musk and his rocket explosion, things of that nature? Space settlement, I hear, got a lot of activity on the Space Review today, although I haven't had a chance to read the articles.
Yeah, I mean, last time I was on was in May, and we did that deep dive into the American Space Renaissance Act. That was, I still have headaches thinking about that one. That was a heck of a show. There is a lot going on. I mean, we're obviously in a busy time of the season. This is a busy year with an election year. We were, less than 2 months away from a critical election. And there's we're getting towards the end of the legislative year, too, so there's a lot of flurry going on. And yes, Mr. Musk is making headlines again with space settlement, and I kind of peruse the Space Review today with space settlement itself. But a lot of my focus hasn't really been on that. I mean, It's been focused on SpaceX. It's been focused on the presidential elections. It's been focused on legislation. And, you know, what the really, really hardcore stuff, maybe not the stuff that really necessarily makes headlines. I guess, you know, one thing that really caught my eye this morning, and I usually, every morning I get up and I scan the headlines to see what's going on so I can and do a few tweets. And one thing that really caught my eye was Gary Johnson, who's the libertarian candidate for president, along with Bill Weld as his vice president candidate, apparently made a statement to ABC News, basically, in so many words, he said he supports space, as president, he would support space settlement. And, you know, I read through the article really quick, and just an off-the-cuff, one cup of coffee into the day thought that came and went out to a tweet was, this is Gary Johnson's moon base moment. And that's referring back to 2012 when Newt Gingrich tried to lay the moon base idea as part of the to try and win in the Florida primary when he was running for president. So I looked at that and I really thought, you know what? Is this space policy? No, this isn't space policy. This is basically a blurb to try and get some attention before these big debates. So I guess I really brought back to the point that, you know what? We haven't heard a lot about space policy from the candidates, and we really won't hear a lot about space policy from the candidates because, down compared to taxes, putting food on the table, national defense, terrorism concerns, it's really kind of a low priority, except for a group of interested people like ourselves. So, in fact, I think it was a couple months ago. It was last month. I sat down and I decided, you know what, I'm going to make a special issue of the Pressy. Now, the idea behind the Pressy is I have four quarterly issues that basically cover the past, what I think is important in the past 3 months. But I also do special issues in between. So I sat down and I wrote my first special issue of the Pressy for my subscribers. And basically, I sat down and I looked at both of the major candidates, which is Donald Trump and Mrs. Clinton, and I thought, based on what I know about them, based on their philosophies, what would their basic positions be on some major space issues in national security and civil space like NASA, and in commercial space. And so I sat down and made a table and wrote out an issue for my subscribers, basically going at that. And the results kind of surprised me in some sense, but my thought was basically, here you have two candidates who have diametric different world views. One is basically a globalist who looks at us as a global community, and the other who is basically geopolitical or nationalist in a sense, who would basically look at the space program through the eyes of a nationalist or geopolitics. And from there, I just kind of went down through a bunch of issues. And like I said, the results were pretty interesting.
Are you there?
I'm still here. Are you here?
Yeah. You disappeared for a second. What'd you come up with the results? Well, I've seen the article, so I know what you came up with. I thought it was an excellent analysis, by the way.
I mean, I think basically, going down Mrs. Clinton, what her philosophies would be as a president, it was basically that the status quo would remain. The way things are right now with the space program, the direction we're heading for in national security space, with the way we're engaged in the world and that where it would remain the same. The same thing with NASA, and she would be very supportive of commercial space. I focused a lot on commercial space because people like Musk and Bezos and such are very much in favor of her for president, and in some cases they have direct access to the White House. Basically Lori Garver, who was basically her policy advisor when she ran last time in 2008, and my guess is she's going to play a pivotal role, if not try and be a NASA administrator this time around if Mrs. Clinton wins the White House. So and Lori is very, very pro commercial space. So I would think Mrs. Clinton would be very pro commercial space in that regards. Mr. Trump, on the other hand, would probably look at national security from a much different standpoint. In other words, he'd be very wary of getting involved into treaties or international agreements versus that. NASA, he would look at NASA kind of almost from an Apollo type of standpoint as, you know what, this would help us do national prestige, but I think he'd be very cognizant about cost overruns and how much money is actually going to waste. And believe it or not, I really think, you know, being a businessman and somebody who's made his fame and fortune in the business world, I think, you know, he would catch up very quickly in the commercial space area and basically mend fences with people like Bezos and the rest of them, and basically be very supportive from a policy standpoint for commercial space.
Well, we'll find out at some point, because one of those two will likely win.
Well, like I said, it's probably going to be around until a national space policy. Another one won't be articulated till 2018. But one of the things I frequently see, you know, I kind of just go through the forums sometimes to see what people are thinking. Sometimes I jump in and just, you know, stir things up a little bit and, you know, make a reality check or two. But one of the concerns I see, it's very partisan-minded right now in the forums. People are very saying, well, Trump's not going to, you know, will kill commercial space, or Trump's not pro-commercial space and the Democrats are. It's very polarized along party lines, and that's really not the truth in the sense, because if you remember, you know, when we talked about last year about, you know, national space policy, well, the Commercial Space Launch Act of 1984 was actually, you know, brought forth by a Democratic senator, and the policy was enunciated by a Republican president. So this is very, you know, commercial space is a very bipartisan thing with the reality check of, of course, they're going to support their constituents in their states if they happen to be commercial space operators or legacy providers.
So you did this analysis a couple of months ago. Have you seen anything on the horizon that has changed any of your perspectives?
No, I think it's pretty static right now. I mean, the space policy, they really haven't enunciated any space policies per se. I mean, basically, the Trump campaign, their policy is basically what the Republican platform came out with. And basically, Mrs. Clinton's is the same. Now, it's interesting that Dr. Jill Stein actually did, the Green Party actually did enunciate a space policy of sort for their platform, and it was basically, we don't want military in space. We don't want manned space program because it's too expensive. We believe in the Earth space for, you know,
climate change,
and all things along that line. So it's a very progressive, and, you know, not really pro-military type of agenda for the Green Party. Gary Johnson, on the other hand, didn't have anything to say at the point when I wrote this, when I wrote the issue. But, you know, now he's coming out a little bit more saying, well, like his blurb that was in, I guess he said yesterday. So they're all over the place. You're not going to get anything firmed down until one of them gets into office and they have their people actually sit down and work out a national space policy for their administration.
Are you taking bets or putting out odds that space will not come up in the debate tonight?
It's not going to. It will not come up in the debate. I will give you a 99.9% odds that it won't come up.
So you're putting your credibility on the line here, right?
I'm putting my credibility on the line. I'm not even going to watch it. I have things on DVR I'm going to watch. I'm just over the whole political thing. But I can guarantee you to that certainty that space won't be part of that debate tonight. Not this debate. Maybe the next two debates it might be brought up, but not in this one.
I would be surprised if it came up in this debate too, especially given the location where the debate is, because there's no space interest particularly in that area. So, but we'll see. Maybe it'll be a surprise question or two that the candidates are caught off guard with.
I mean, you know, like I said, it's you know, and I've said this before. We've all want you know, space policy to be really, you know, right on the forefront and up in front in the candidates' minds, but it's really down on the totem pole in the concerns of other people, right under, you know, can I put food on my? I got to be able to put food on my table. How high are my taxes going to go up? And you know, are we going to have a terrorist attack, you know, in our neighborhood tomorrow? Those are obviously very primary concerns, and space policy kind of gets knocked down near the bottom of the totem pole.
You have a question from Lee, and Lee is in New York City, not too far, mm-hmm. not too far from you. And Lee says, I'm curious about your opinion. Musk tweeted what they think was the cause of the accident. I've been looking for follow-up news on this to see if the other investigative parties, NASA, the FAA, and the Air Force, are signing off on that cause, but I haven't seen it, though it may be out there. First of all, do you know if the cause of that accident has been signed on to by all of those involved in the investigation? And does that mean now that they know the cause, they can go on and plan and put on the schedule additional launches?
Well, there's going to be a huge disclaimer here. I'm not a technical guy, and I defer that to other people who are a lot smarter about it than I am. I will tell you from what I have read, they haven't found the cause. They found out what happened, which was, from what I understand, a massive failure of the helium system in there in the second stage. But from what I understand, they haven't found out what caused that failure. So saying they found the cause really isn't accurate. They found out what happened, what caused the explosion, but they haven't, from what I understand, they haven't pinpointed what happened to the helium to actually cause that failure. So it's kind of a two-stage thing. They're kind of working backwards to find out what happened to it. Again, I defer to people who are a lot smarter and more adept at this type of thing. I'm not the technical guy. I know just enough to make me dangerous. And just, you know, enough to actually look at some policy thing, some policy angles. But other than that, I don't have an answer for that.
So you don't think that this is a done deal with a green flag to move forward? You think there's more to come?
I think there probably will be more to come. I don't think the investigation's over. As you know, my second special issue of my briefing letter, I specifically addressed what happened, and in fact, I published it on the second, the day after, on September 2nd. And one of the things I pointed out was there's going to be a lot of publicity, a lot of people in the blogosphere, in the media, and whatnot, basically trying to, for lack of a better term, spin this, or basically downplay what actually happened, and that basically came true. A lot of people, and almost immediately, people started coming out and saying, "Well, you know, you got to, in order to make progress, you know, you got to, these things happen. This is the part of the game and stuff." And that's well and true. And I think what we're seeing right now here is potentially part of that prediction happening. In other words, yes, we found out, you know, it was a massive failure of the helium system, but what really isn't being said is, we haven't found, you know, what actually caused the helium system to fail in the first place. So I'm very wary of spin, of semantics, and, you know, how publicity is used to, you know, basically downplay events. I guess it goes back to the Debbie Downer thing. I look beyond the veil of things and look at the substance and whether I like it or not. And I think this might be a case where they're trying to at least put a good face on a bad situation.
Lee had a second part to his email.
Sure.
And Lee's second part is, do you think that when Musk gives his talk tomorrow on going to Mars and whatever else he throws in there, that it will be a talk that policy holders will look at and consider, and will it influence NASA and U.S. space policy?
I would have to listen to his speech, listen to his talk. I may tune in if I have time tomorrow. My guess is this is more, he likes to be in the headlines, and that's fine. I mean, you know, we tend, you know, this is part of his character, part of the way he built his company. He likes being in the headlines, and I think this is one way of putting his company back, keeping his company in the headlines. On the other hand, when people get excited about that and pay attention to things like his new Mars transporter or settlement ideas, their attention is taken away from their issues. I tend to, you know, people accuse me of being a negative guy because I always said, okay, that's fun, but what about the problems over here? What have you done? So I'm one of the bad guys, I suppose, in a sense that I'm saying, yeah, these plans might be exciting and everything, but it's taking attention away from what's going on with the rocket and the investigation. So again, it's, you know, as a lawyer, we basically, you know, we have skills in the way we do our motions and our briefs and our arguments in court. We try to take attention away from the negative aspects of our, you know, of our argument or our case. In the sense, the same thing is happening here with in corporate communications, in my opinion, is basically, yes, this is going to excite a lot of people. Yes, I'm sure he's pre-planned on this, but even before the incident happened on the pad. But at the same time, it is going to provide a nice distraction, in my opinion, away from the actual issue of, you know, what happened to this rocket. And yes, these Mars plans are exciting, but, you know, we got to get this rocket fixed too, so that we can facilitate those plans.
So I have another. I guess it's a regulatory law question, not mm-hmm. particularly about space, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway.
All right.
This is an email from Jason in Boston. And Jason says, I'm at work, so I can't pick up the phone. My question does not really apply to space, but hopefully you can answer it. I am concerned, and so are millions of other Americans, that on October 1st, the Internet will start being controlled by the United Nations and its players and mix of players that are not particularly friendly to the United States, let alone to the West. Many people are upset and very worried about this. In terms of procedure, if Trump were to win the presidency, and he has said he's not in support of the UN controlling the Internet, once he was sworn in, can he just say, we're taking it back, to hell with you, and break the deal to give it to the UN, or once October 1st comes, it's a totally done deal?
That's a good question, and I don't have a complete answer for it. It depends on what type of agreement it is. I admittedly have not been following this a lot, but if it's an executive action, there is, you know, there's always a potential it can be undone. If it's probably not a treaty. And I'm pretty certain that it's not a treaty because the Senate would definitely not hear it and not ratify it. So my guess is probably some sort of political agreement or executive agreement that basically turn over this. And depending on the nature of it, there is a potential that it could be undone. Like I said, I haven't seen the agreement. I'm not sure of the exact nature of the agreement. So that would have a lot to do with whether or not it could be pulled back. There's very likely it could be. It might cause a lot of logistical problems. But on the other hand, it's really hard to say without knowing the true nature of the agreement.
I would imagine if they pulled it back, it would ruffle some feathers for sure, right?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, you know, it's, you know, basically, you know, the game, the world of geopolitics and the game of geopolitics is you're going to ruffle somebody's feathers, and, you know, you just can't, you're not going to make everybody happy. Boy, I know that from, you know, just being, you know, normal life and being a lawyer and being a space lawyer. I definitely don't make a lot of people happy when I basically look at something and basically say, you know, speak my mind. So I guess ruffling feathers is secondary, but then again, somebody, you know, a presenter like Mr. Trump, he really isn't afraid to ruffle feathers either.
Okay, so I'm hoping you can give our friend a better answer if this internet page will pull up. But it appears that he's allowing bylaws to expire
mm-hmm.
without renewing them, and
mm-hmm.
and that would mean the UN could take over. Because something has expired that
mm-hmm.
was not renewed. So does that help you clarify whether you could undo it or not if another president came in and didn't like it?
It might. Maybe he could. He could probably parlay a lot of political pressure on the UN, saying, "Look, we're renewing this. This is our administration. We're going to renew it." Congress might be able to do something, might try and do something in the interim. I know, I recall Senator Ted Cruz has been kind of leading the charge on this to make sure that, that the UN doesn't gain control over the internet, and we retain that authority here in the United States. So, there is a possibility Congress might try to take some sort of action to at least stall it until the next administration comes in.
But they would be stalling it after October 1st. So my, and I guess Jason's understanding is as well that the transfer takes place on October 1st.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line is, I think the only thing I can think of is the Senate has been working on something, and they've been really going, they've been up in arms over this, and they may be working on sort of legal or legislative fix to try and, or spending clause to actually, prevent this from happening. Again, like I said, I don't know a lot about the situation to really articulate a good rational answer. I apologize for that.
Well, if there are any listeners out there that happen to have an expertise in this area, I know it's not directly related to space, but give us a call or send in an email with your expertise, and we'll listen or read what you have to say. There's also on the Space Review, and I'm hearing from other sources, there seems to be some kind of push all of a sudden for space settlement. And I mean, it's not all of a sudden. I know the new space community has been trying to get it into congressional laws for a couple of years, and it hasn't come up. They were told that what's his name from Orange County was going to introduce legislation for it, and they wanted to change the space policy so it would become part of the actual charter for NASA. What is happening from your perspective with policy and law on the issue of space settlement?
Well, I think space settlement is something I really don't spend a lot of time in, because I am more concerned about the here and now. But my opinion with space settlement is it's just like Mars. And let me clarify that. There's been a big push, we need to do a mission to Mars. We need to do a mission to Mars. In fact, in the current NASA Authorization Act, there's a lot of provisions saying, policy provisions from Congress saying, we've got to continue on with these programs that will eventually get us to Mars. The problem is you can make policy statements and put it in legislation and pass it and saying, yes, this is our sense of Congress is we need to do this. Until the executive branch and a national space policy says, it's part of our policy is to basically create, to do a manned mission to Mars, sustained mission, and do sustained settlement in our space, or at least create a policy where we encourage sustained settlement in outer space, it's not going to happen. Congress can pass all the bills they want, but in giving their sense and giving their policy position, it's not going to happen. Until Congress writes a bill with a Mars provision or a space settlement provision that actually directly funds that effort, I don't pay much attention to it, because it's basically saying, yes, we acknowledge it and this is important, but we're not going to directly appropriate any money to actually do it. Basically, the idea is money talks. When I see money being directly appropriated to a Mars mission, specifically saying, this X amount of money is dedicated not to a program that will eventually get us to Mars, but to a actual manned mission to Mars, I'm not going to pay attention to it. Same thing with space settlement. If basically the Congress says, this is a good idea and everything, and we're actually going to put money to it and direct NASA to start working in this area and give them a specific amount of money to do it, I really don't pay attention to it, because it's basically just political talk.
Well, let's take it from another perspective. The private sector wants to push it and go for it. Is there anything that you would see coming out of the public sector that might try to stop it via regulation or policy?
That's a good question. I know right now with some of the bills, we delved ad nauseum into the American Space Renaissance Act back in May.
Right.
And one of the things that I noticed in that was, Senator Brinstein really was big on new commercial habitats, basically for government astronauts. But this is that's an impetus to basically develop them for private use as well. But again, I want to see, what I need to see is a national space policy that basically says, yes, we're going to encourage private companies to start doing private settlement. And then, you know, basically, once they had that policy, basically, you know, Congress, coming in and saying, well, this is a good thing, we're going to let them do their own thing with their own money. And basically the laws to actually allow the FAA to authorize those types of activities. When I start seeing that, then I start really looking at it hard and saying, okay, there's something substantive here. But right now, you know, there is nothing in the national space policy that says we encourage commercial space settlement. And right now, the way the laws are written and the authority the FAA has, I don't think they really have the authority right now to come out and give a license, authorize a mission for something like commercial space settlement. That's just my field of things.
Except they do have a license to let you land on the moon, apparently. They do have the authority to do that.
That's something interesting. That's Moon Express. They don't have a license to land on the moon. But what happened was they had to go, as part of their license application, they had to go through what was called the payload review process. And basically, hats off to Moon Express. They were extremely proactive in this with the FAA working with them. Basically, they convinced the FAA this wasn't going to violate, you know, this would be consistent with the U.S. obligations under the Outer Space Treaty. But the primary reason that they were able to get that license was this is basically, the FAA basically looks at this as a technology demonstration mission. It's not a mission to actually go and mine resources or set up a settlement. The Google Lunar X project is basically about technology demonstration. So basically the FAA's opinion was, given the current regulatory authority we have from Congress would allow us to authorize a technology mission, demonstration mission, but beyond that, anything that has to do with settlement or mining or such, we don't think we have the authority right yet.
Interesting.
And it's actually interesting you say that because one of the things I've been talking about with a certain member of Congress was our friend Senator Bridenstine. I was reading I always read space policy online. Marcia Smith. She does a lot of awesome work from that. And I was perusing it last week, and I guess Representative Bridenstine basically revealed a draft legislation for what he calls enhanced payload review, which would basically amend the current commercial space statutes and would give the FAA broader authority to actually license some of these missions like on-orbit servicing, like asteroid mining, possibly even settlement. It's basically a way of streamlining it and actually, you know, giving the FAA the authority it needs to actually work with these commercial companies and approve, license these missions for these, how can you say, non-traditional space activities. I mean, it's a pretty interesting piece of legislation. Actually, a little plug for my briefing letter is that I talk about that and I analyze the statute and I talk about that in the issue that's coming out on Friday.
By the way, while you're talking about it, how do people get to read the Precis?
If you want to subscribe to the Precis, go to my website, spacelawsolutions.com. If you look in the right-hand tab, you'll see a little tab for the Precis. You click on it, and it'll bring you to the page for the Precis. You can scroll down, and it basically explains it all. I do is I have my subscriptions all listed out. You can pay via either PayPal, or you can email me and give me your phone number and I'll call you, or you can call me and I will process your credit card right over the telephone. I just got a brand new merchant account for credit cards. It was just activated today, so I'm all set up to accept credit cards directly if you don't want to go through PayPal. But more importantly, if you really want to get a feel for the letter to see if you want to spend, well, for an individual, membership, it's $199 for a year, and that gets you four quarterly issues, plus any special issues that are in between. And special issues could be anywhere from three to 12 special issues a year, depending on what's going on and, you know, what I feel my readers need to see. But the big thing is I have a link on there that says if you want a free issue, if you want issue one of the Pressy that I put out back on July 29th, you send me an email. You ask for the free issue of the Pressy, and I will email you the PDF. And you can look at it, and you can decide for yourself if the Pressy is for you, and if you want to subscribe for a year of it. I'm not going to try and sell you that this is the greatest publication in the world, and you have to read it. I encourage you to click the email link and email me and ask for the free issue, so you can read for yourself, and so if you can decide for yourself if the Pressy is for you or is not for you. I think that's a fair way of doing it, and that kind of feeds into my whole thing of no hyperbole. I want you to figure out whether or not it's for you, and yeah. And a lot of people have taken advantage of the free issue.
And listeners, I have read it, and it's really outstanding. So. I certainly would recommend it for you.
I don't want to go too far off track what we're talking about, but I'm really enthusiastic about it. Things have been starting to really open up these past couple weeks. I just closed my first subscription for my first government subscriber, my first government institution subscriber. So I was really excited about that, and I actually have another government subscriber in the works right now. Probably close that maybe at the end of the week, hopefully. So it's really getting out there. I've gotten some awesome, David. I've gotten some incredible feedback about it. Some really constructive feedback from people who are lawyers, people who are in the media, people who are basically commentators, and even policymakers. You know, have given me some amazing feedback and been very, you know, very supportive of the Pressy. And to be honest and to be truthful, I'm really humbled by it, and just not letting it go to my head, and just charging forward because you know, just like one person told me, you know, in an email, she said, "You've got a really high quality publication," and it's like, well, that so there's really a high, you know, I've set a high bar, and I intend to keep, you know, holding up that bar to give quality content for my subscribers.
Very good. So, what do you see for international pressure that might be coming our way? Like, for example, is there any pressure for us to actually make formal the law of the sea treaty? I mean, that was an issue earlier on, which might have ramifications for the moon treaty. Has that died down, or is there still some pressure on that?
There's still a lot of pressure to, to ratify the UN Law of the Sea Treaty, Convention on Law of the Sea. That's not going to abate. I mean, I'm going to stop the Moon Treaty discussion right here and tell you it's not going to. The Moon Treaty, I don't think, is going to go anywhere. I thought maybe a few months ago it might push forward a little bit more, but right now the way I'm looking at things, the Moon Treaty is being ignored, is basically being brushed aside, and I don't think anything, you know, there's going to be enough political muscle to actually get it moving again. But it's interesting you brought up the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, because a very, very interesting thing happened on July 12th that had to do with the Law of the Sea, and this has to do with the situation in the South China Sea, basically what China, territorial claims that China has made. Essentially what happened is they're making, as anybody who's, you know, reading the news knows, they have made some territorial claims in the South China Sea, basically going, they basically created these islands, and they're basically saying, you know, we basically claim sovereignty for 12 miles from around these artificial constructs. Well, the Philippines challenged them in the Permanent Court of Arbitrations in Brussels at the Hague, and basically the Hague ruled against China and said no, these things don't count as real islands. You made them up on your own, and these rocks that you're claiming as islands aren't islands; they're just rocks. So they said no. Now, prior to this, China basically was on a big campaign to. They knew they were going to get a bad decision. They were on a very big campaign to tamp down the effect of this agreement. And they got a lot of people, they pressured a lot of countries that they do business with to support their interpretation and basically reinterpret the UN law of the Sea Treaty, that particular article, I think it was Article 22, to their advantage. And right now, we're a couple months out of that decision, that arbitration decision, and really there hasn't been a lot of diplomatic pressure to bear to make the South China Sea, you know, basically make them renounce those claims in the South China Sea. And I use claims in quotes because they're couching it in terms where they're not really claiming sovereignty. That would get them in a lot of trouble. But they're saying it's sovereign, but they're saying it's sovereign, but they're not really saying it's sovereign. The geopolitical dance, so to speak. This has, and this really troubled me a lot. And I thought about it for a while and figured, well, am I paranoid? And I talked to a few other experts in international law and said, no, you're not paranoid. You're spot on. And here's my concern. Basically, this goes back to the asteroid bill that was passed almost coming a year ago. The U.S. basically made a very, very interesting customary interpretation of Article 2 and Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty when they declared this right of the space resources. My concern is that China is looking at this very interesting. They're very interested in this, from what I would have understand, and they are going to agree to that customary interpretation of Article 1 and Article 2. My concern is right now they have made a very interesting customary interpretation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And now they may take this customary interpretation that the United States has made and that is kind of catching on very heavily and use that to their advantage to make a further interpretation that may eventually give them the ability to go to the moon or other places and say, you know what, we're going to send a commercial company to the planet, to say the moon or an asteroid. And not only are we going to claim the resources, we're going to claim the territory for a certain amount of area around where our company is as sovereign, you know, as sovereign territory under the control of China.
But they've signed the Outer Space Treaty.
But my concern, and here's my concern, they have shown their willingness to interpret the rule of law in the law of the sea to their geopolitical advantage, and nobody has done anything forceful enough, both diplomatically or shown any resolve through custom, to actually deny it. I mean, when the State Department gave its response, its official response to the arbitral decision. I mean, I was like, it was weak. I mean, it's like you guys couldn't have done it any better than this. I mean, it was very weak. It wasn't forceful. It was like, well, we're really concerned. We're, you know, almost like we're very concerned about this and wish they hadn't done this, but that was about it. My concern is this only emboldens China to take the next step and basically reinterpret some of the articles in some of the provisions of the Outer Space Treaty to their geopolitical advantage as well. And I think the United States basically laid the groundwork to actually do that through this customary interpretation of Article 2 and Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty to create this, quote, right for space resources for U.S. citizens. I talk about it in the first issue of the Pressy. So actually, if you want to go to the site and request the free issue, you'll kind of get a glimpse of what I'm talking about. Now, this kind of dovetails into another thing that I talk about in the first issue, and I'll talk a little bit more about in the issue coming out on Monday, is China is reported to be, is going to have announced their own private commercial space law by the end of the year. In other words, they're going to give their private citizens the right to perform commercial space activities. So all this is falling into place where it could basically get to a point where maybe 10 years down the road, 10, 15 years down the road, they could probably start twisting the interpreting the Outer Space Treaty to their advantage. And you know what? I'm gonna give a big shout out apology to Bob Bigelow, because a few years ago he basically made you know, voice the concern that, you know, China could go to the moon, renounce the Outer Space Treaty, and claim the moon. I kind of owe him an apology because I was very critical about that. And I think, you know what? I think Bob was on the right track with this. I don't think that, you know, but in this case, I don't think China is in a position to go to the moon and renounce the Outer Space Treaty as much as they go to the moon, reinterpret the Outer Space Treaty to their own advantage. Nobody complains about it, and boom, they start claiming sovereign patches of the moon or other celestial bodies.
So
I'm not the crazy guy with a sandwich card going out and saying this. There are a lot of other people in the international community who are China experts who look at this and say, you're not wrong.
So is this a factor of our failure to respond to China, and should we stand up to China somehow on the South China Seas and respond to them?
I think this is a direct, this is a symptom of us not taking a more forceful approach diplomatically and showing, you know, and flexing a little bit of muscle in the South China Sea. We're doing these things called freedom of navigation patrols, where basically the idea is we reassert that the, you know, international waters by going through these claimed territories and saying, well, this is a fun, you know, by going through there and by, you know, China, based on China's reaction, we reinforce customs saying, no, this isn't international water. The problem is these type of operations require going in very belligerently with fire control radars on and being very loud about it and saying, you know, we don't recognize your territorial claim. We recognize this as international waters. We haven't been doing that. We haven't been doing what we call these FONs appropriately to really reinforce to China that we don't recognize this territory, we don't recognize this claim you've made. It's been a very, very soft pedal approach. And like I said, I think this has emboldened them internationally to take, you know, their reinterpretation or what they consider the rule of law is from the law of the sea and take the next step to actually going to the Outer Space Treaty.
Since it is unlikely that we're going to respond to China, do you think our policymakers who are creating our policy are thinking ahead to lunar issues or space issues? Or what do you hear that the insiders say is the thinking process of our policymakers?
I don't talk with the policymakers directly, but I belong to an interesting email group. And it's very China-centric, and it's very focused on China's activities and what they're doing in the world and such. And there's a lot of experts in there, but, you know, in the military, in think tanks and such. And the consensus is China is exerting itself. It sees weakness and it sees opportunity at this point, and is taking advantage of this to make these extra claims and to really establish itself more as a dominant player in the Asia Pacific region. From my perspective, I don't think China's bent on world domination per se. But my feeling is they really want control of, they want to be the dominant power in the Asia-Pacific region, and they want us to butt out. But on the other hand, and they also want to influence the Western Hemisphere through economics and soft power and media and such like that. I mean, some people in academia will say, well, you're an alarmist, you're a conservative. I'm sorry, I'm just calling it like I see it. I'm not sugarcoating it. I'm telling you what I see, and I'm not the only one who's saying it either.
Any idea how it's going to play out and how the presidential election impacts it?
I am concerned right now. It's going to depend who gets elected. And I think if Mrs. Clinton gets elected, China will keep on soft pedaling it, you know, and trying, you know, and just creeping into the South China Sea area. If Mr. Trump gets it, I think they will blatantly make a territory, come out and blatantly say, this is our territory, keep out.
And they will push him to see what he will do, right?
I think they will make a territorial claim before he actually gets sworn into office to entrench themselves to make it more difficult to get him out. My joke among the group that I belong to was, if Mrs. Clinton gets elected, all the globes will stay the same. If Mr. Trump gets elected, well, we're probably going to have to start changing the globes as far as the Asia-Pacific region goes.
You have another email from
sure.
Adrian in San Diego. As the old saying goes, possession is 9/10 of the law. So if anyone else is ruffled by South China Sea possession or future astronomical body ownership, either get there first and keep it or go and take it away from the one claiming it.
Well, that's, you know, that's a pretty simple way of putting it, and I think that really kind of sums up what's going on in the South China Sea right now. I try not to lose sleep over it because I can't do anything about it, but I'm very cognizant that this is, you know, this is an issue. A lot of people come out and say, no, you're being an alarmist and, you know, China isn't going to do this. But I beg to differ because a lot of experts that I correspond with say quite differently. But Adrian makes a very good point. That simplifies it right down to a very simplistic level. But, yeah, he's right.
So is this what wars are made of?
This is what wars are made of, and I guess the point with this is, A, are we, you know, if China makes a territorial claim and they get entrenched in there, is it worth a war to go in and try and dislodge them? Because diplomacy isn't going to dislodge them at that point. And B, if things start occurring in outer space with the moon and other celestial bodies, I mean, what is the response going to be? How are you going to, you know, respond to that?
I don't know. Does having the smallest navy since before World War II enter into this for the U.S.?
Well, you know, sometimes it doesn't matter, you know, having how big your force is, matter what you're willing to do with it. I mean, yeah, people will say, well, you're advocating war. No, I'm not advocating war. I don't want a war. Anybody in their right mind doesn't want a war. But, you know, some situations like this get us to a point where sometimes it takes a war to actually resolve a situation that could have been resolved by being a little bit more bold and, you know, and assertive in the first place.
One more question, and then we're going to
sure.
take our break and chill out so we don't go to war here on the space show.
Yeah, exactly.
This is from Doc Doug in Southern California, and he says, do you think that if China created a network of centered, S-I-N-T-E-R-E-D, roads to the moon, I don't know if that's a misprint or otherwise I don't know what centered means, of centered roads on the moon, that this would extend the amount of area that they could claim as for their exclusive use?
I don't know.
Do you know what?
That's a good question.
What are centered roads? Is this something I don't know?
I mean, I don't. It probably better if he called and explained what centered roads are. I'm not sure I understand the concept. I'm thinking of highway systems. I mean, I'm envisioning highway systems. Call in, Doug, after the break and explain.
Email. Maybe it's a typo, Doug. I don't know. It's a term I'm not familiar with, so I apologize for that. But if you're unable to give us a call, certainly send in an email for no other reason than to clarify it for me. Let's see, is this, no, this is for the show the other day. Okay, this is a good point for all of us to pause, take a deep breath, and not go to war, at least until we come back for the second half of the grand showdown, right?
Yep.
And in the meantime, if you kind of like what Michael is saying and how he thinks and how he talks, his quarterly report is really thought-provoking, and I am very favorably impressed by it. And so there you go. Everybody stay put, and we will be back, and don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, Your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday Space Show program. Michael Listener is our guest. We have a caller on hold, a very interesting email I will read, and we have two sponsors to thank. One is Celestis, and boy, if the world keeps going the way it's going, a lot of us may be using Celestis services. Anyway, 12 people have walked on the moon, and one person is actually buried there, and that's Dr. Eugene Shoemaker. He was known primarily for discovering Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 that hit Jupiter in 1994. He also played a role in training astronauts throughout the American Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico. He wanted to be an astronaut, but his health did not allow him to do that. But his ashes were sent aboard NASA Lunar Prospector that impacted the lunar surface in July of 99. And this is what Celestis is all about, helping people fulfill the dream of spaceflight, even if they're going to experience it in some other unknown realm, since they didn't get to do it while they were alive. And AIAA is a sponsor. That's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members. They shape the future of aerospace every day. So go visit their website, AIAA.org. And their journal on propulsion, if you read the archive summary I wrote from the Brandenburg show yesterday, is the one that is going to be printing the Eagle Works paper in December on their evaluation and critique of M-Drive. I put all that information in the archive summary of yesterday's show with Dr. Brandenburg. Before we go to our call, Adrian sent in a follow-up note, which I want to read real quickly, and Michael, I don't know if it needs your comments or not, but you're certainly welcome to comment on it. Japan says it scrambled fighter jets on Sunday after 8 Chinese military aircraft flew between Japanese islands. The planes, thought to be bombers, surveillance planes, and a fighter jet flew along the Miyako Straits between Okinawa and Miyako-jima. China said about 40 of its aircraft were involved in what it said was a routine drill. I guess it's routine from their perspective. And then Adrian provides the BBC URL for the story that he's reporting on. So that's a follow-up to what we were talking about at the close.
That's not surprising. That's been happening a lot. And that's basically you know, China flexing its muscles in the area. They've been doing it a lot more since that Permanent Court of Arbitration decision to reinforce that they're not moved. They're not going anywhere. It's a concerning situation, and like I said, it's going to bleed over into international space law.
Dr. Doug from Southern California is with us to bring peace and harmony to the world. So as we go peacefully to the moon, so Doug, welcome. We haven't heard from you for a while. I want to know how. Well, this is not really your show to do that, but. You want to do a show on your lobbying experiences in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, a lot of things happen, so I think...
Okay, I don't want to do it on Michael's show. So I'm going to send you the dates as soon as I get off the phone with Michael, okay?
Right.
Okay, so your call for today, what's going on?
Well, so just following up on the centering of the road, basically my thinking is the easiest type of road to produce, which would be really quite useful, would be to have sort of like an Apollo-sized vehicle, you know, that our astronauts drove around on, to for the Chinese to go ahead and land something like that in preparation for crew.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the back of the vehicle.
Are you there, Doug? Hello, Doug. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Testing for Doug's cell phone. This is why I don't like cell phones. Are you there, Doug? Doug, are you there? Hello. Okay, Doug. We can't hear you, so call back. Michael, hopefully you're there, Michael. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I think he explained during the break. He explained a little bit what he was talking about, and what he was describing was basically sounded to me like physical improvements to the terrain that China might make. And I think his question was, would that basically help them in a territorial claim? I would equate something like that to building artificial islands in the South China Sea. Building artificial constructs and improving the area and claiming a sovereignty. So something like a road, something like roads, building roads like that, that like Doug explained in the polar regions of the moon to get from one place to the other could be considered an improvement by the, a national improvement. And it could be, a argument for this is Chinese territory. Depending on how you want to interpret the Outer Space Treaty. I guess bottom line, what I'm getting at with this whole thing is, once we start twisting, the U.S. really started twisting treaties around, the Outer Space Treaty around to get to space resources. Now, I'm not going to go into why I disagree with it, because we've been down that road before, and a lot of people don't agree with me and are frankly quite angry with me because of my opinions. But I'm just saying, the international implications to what's going to happen to the fabric of international law, how it can be molded because of that decision, kind of concerns me very much. And I think this is one of the areas that concerns me.
This is from the Commercial Space Act of December 2015, right?
Yeah, that one section 51303 is the asteroid bill, the quote asteroid act that basically grants rights to use space resources.
Section 51303, correct?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I talk about it. Like I said, it's in my first issue of the Pressy, which you can get free if you want. If you email me, I talk about it a little bit in one of my sections, and I talk a little bit about it in the issue coming up on Friday.
Sort of for every action, there's a reaction.
Pretty much, yeah.
including in policy, right?
Well, I look at international law like this. It's basically like ripples in a pond. You throw a stone in the pond, the water around it isn't going to stay still. There are going to be ripples. And same thing with international law. Once you start interpreting it, using custom to interpret the Outer Space Treaty or international or any body of international law, that leaves ripples in the rest of the fabric of international law.
So if we ask you to put on your magic eight ball hat, how do you predict 5 years down the road on all of this stuff?
A lot of it rests on what happens with this election coming up. If Mrs. Clinton, I want you to understand this is nonpartisan. I'm just telling you my objective opinion. If Mrs. Clinton becomes president, things will continue on. China will be emboldened to continue on the way it's doing right now, making these gradual claims. And 5 years down the road, with this new law in place, depending on what their quote private companies do, they could start influencing international law and basically molding it for their geopolitical benefit as well. If Mr. Trump gets in, he may be a little bit more firm and stand up to him and convince him to back down from any interpretations that might actually claim sovereign extraterrestrial territory.
But none of this is going to reach the level of a political campaign discussion or issue. I mean, we're talking something so esoteric that even the media reporters wouldn't have a clue what we're talking about.
Well, and that's it. And bottom line is, these candidates have so much they have to deal with, so much they got to be up on. This is minutia. This really is minutia, believe. This is minutia. This is little things. It's very, very small, but in the grand scheme of things, it has big effects. When either of them gets in the office, they don't do all this. They don't sit down and do this all on their own. They have policy advisors sit down and say, look, this is the way things are. If we do this, this is going to happen. If we don't do this, this is what's going to happen. Maybe we should do this. So that's why a president has a lot of advisors around him or her, to basically help them to set policy decisions for space, for all aspects of rule. I mean, being the president is the most awesome responsibility in the world. Not, you know, just because, you know, you have so many things to contend with, and the fact that you have, the ability to kill millions of people if, you know, somebody, you know, if it comes to that. So it's an awesome responsibility, and I've watched a lot of every president I've watched who's been in office, I think, except for Reagan, he didn't go gray, but every other president after that who got in, right from President Clinton, right to President Bush to President Obama, they've gone gray after 8 years. It's that immense of a responsibility, and there's so much to it.
This is why we have such high-quality, incredible candidates running for president.
It's, you know, we have to play the hand we're dealt in this case. And really, you know, it was a decision. This is what the primary process was about, to, you know, select the people that we want for president. And you know what, obviously, in my own personal opinion, I have my own political preferences. But I hope that whoever becomes president will have the wisdom and have the policy advisors around him or her that will help make good decisions that are not only good for the world, but, you know, good for the United States, but good for the world, too.
Are you applying to be a policy advisor for one of these candidates?
Oh, God, they'd have to pay me a hell of a lot of money.
they probably do pay a hell of a lot of money for their policy.
They'd have to pay me a lot of money.
Doug sent in a note and said that you did summarize him correctly. And he sent in another email, says, do you think that the Chinese space program being under the military means that they could be building a human lunar lander without our knowing about it?
I have no idea. I'm not really sure. I wouldn't speculate that far, because I really don't know. But I would say the fact that, you know, my concern with the Chinese space program, which goes to my I'm not for cooperation with China, is the military is entwined with the
space
program.
Yeah,
exactly.
So,
exactly. And that's my big thing against cooperation with China.
Maybe Adrian will get picked up as an advisor. He seems like he'd toe the road pretty tight.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, they'd have to pay me a heck of a lot of money to play the games and stuff down in there. I don't know, maybe if it pays well enough, I suppose.
Well, I'd take the pay, but I'd probably be fired, because I don't think I could be a hard ass enough.
I have no problem being a hard ass, but, you know, it's just a matter of probably lose the rest of my hair.
You have to be a hard ass and play the political game. I'm not so sure, I mean, in the policy area, but just with people wanting to knife you in the back and the politics of the office and all of that.
I'm a lawyer, and, you know, I'm a lawyer, and I'm used to that type of stuff.
I guess you could be a ruthless SOB, but I'd probably have
I deal a lot of politics, you know, in the space arena and stuff like that, and it's second nature. I'm just used to it.
What else do you see as things that we should be focusing on? We're coming into the end of 2016. It's hard to believe that the year is almost over with. I'm stunned.
The year is just flashed by. It's been amazing. A development that's happened, I think it was about a month ago, the United Arab Emirates actually approved their space policy. They are not publishing the text of their space policy, but they published a space policy. I talk about this in Friday's, the issue coming out on Friday, read, and from what I understand from my contacts, is it's not a national space policy as we would figure, like the United States has. In other words, it doesn't look at military, civil, and space. It's more geared towards the civil their civil space program and their desire to actually become, you know, be involved in commercial space activities in the UAE as well. I guess it touches on national security issues, but it doesn't really. My understanding is it didn't really bring in their national security organs when they actually created the space policy. So in my understanding, it's a national space policy in title, but it's not national space policy as we would, you know, as we're familiar with here in the United States, and that I talked about last year on this show, and I think back to your class a few months ago as well. So, but that's still a significant development. So they're going forward. They still haven't come out with their space law yet. This has been, I mean, from the way they were talking last year, it should have been out by now. But I've heard some things through contacts that I won't repeat here about it. But my understanding is it's going to have an space resource provision in it as well. So they're basically they're jumping on the bandwagon, just like Luxembourg is jumping on the bandwagon with the space resource thing. And by putting it in this law, they're hedging their bets that this is going to be an accepted practice in the future, and they want to make sure they're not left out of it.
What about New Zealand? They have a commercial space law now, too.
Yeah, actually, they don't have it yet. No, Denmark did. Remember, we talked about, last time we talked, Denmark, their space law went into effect in July. And I've heard some mixed reviews from it. I guess some commercial operators are not happy with it. But, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, a lot of times, you know, there's always going to be, you know, rough patches with new laws and stuff, but it is in force in Denmark. New Zealand actually, it hasn't yet addressed their space law. They actually just entered it. It just got read into their parliament, I think last week. Last I checked, it was first reading, and they plan to have it enacted by sometime in 2017. I believe they said by the middle of 2017, it should be signed into law. Now here's a kicker: Firefoot Rocket Labs wants to launch their Electron rocket from New Zealand to launch SmallSats, CubeSats.
Well, then they're doing Moon Express from there.
They're going to Moon Express is also going to launch from there. But in the end, right now, they want to test their rocket from New Zealand. In order to do that, they had to get special dispensation from the New Zealand government to actually do it. So while this law is being, you know, worked out in Parliament before it's signed into law, from what I understand, the New Zealand government actually signed, you know, basically gave them approval to, you know, do their Electron rocket test from the launch site in New Zealand while they're working things out. So that New Zealand's pretty hot on this, and they really understand, you know, the significance of it. There's actually I go back to the letter again. I have links in the letter. And in fact, even in the first issue, to the website, and you can actually look at a draft of the law and such to see what actually is being debated right now, and might eventually what it's actually might look like once it gets passed into law. But yeah, they're really hot on it. So I mean, you know, these domestic space laws are popping up all over the place, and the idea of commercial space is, you know, catching on as all over the place. So yeah, I mean, what I'm really waiting for is to watch India, you know, actually say we need a national space policy and a domestic space law.
Well,
and that would be significant because there's a big issue right now about, you know, CubeSats, you know, launching U.S. payloads on their what they call a PSLV, which actually did launch. I think it was either today or yesterday. It was a successful launch too. So I wrote something for a friend in India about that and such. And I don't think I talked about it in the letter. But yeah, India is another place to look at too to see if they actually create a domestic space law.
Dr. Plata has another email for you. He says, it seems like most all other countries with a space program want to see their astronauts walking on the moon. But America has chosen to neglect human lunar return. Could you conceive of China becoming the lead in space by developing and providing lunar access to the other nations?
Oh, sure. It's entirely possible. In fact, they're doing something right now. They're doing something similar with their proposed space station that's going to be they're going to begin construction in 2018, and it's supposed to be completed in 2022. A few months ago, they went back in March. They signed an agreement with the UN to basically cooperation with their space station, and basically they're going to let developing countries come in and, you know, perform experiments on their space station, and down the road they may even allow foreign astronauts to, you know, launch on one of their rockets up to their space station. Back to the letter. In the letter coming out on on Friday, I talk about this and some of my concerns and stuff like this. But it was a brilliant move on China's part because it gives them great political optics as leading the way in space, not just for their own country, but for other countries as well. So, I mean, from their standpoint, it's a brilliant maneuver. Doug, you're right on with that. It's highly conceivable they could do that in the future. It may be 10, 15 years down the road, but it's entirely conceivable.
And, of course, we may come up with a different position and a different policy toward our astronauts going to the moon, where that might not happen for China's benefit but might happen for our benefit. I don't think the ending is written on us and the moon yet.
Well, I see the moon. I don't see the moon as a government Apollo type program again. You know, to say, hey, we came back and now we're going to go back. I think you're going to see a lot more private public partnerships, and where commercial space and NASA are going to work together and go back to the moon. I don't see there may be commercial ventures on their own, but I see the bulk of them actually being, you know, the government working along with the commercial space industry to actually facilitate, you know, a return to the moon and actual work on the moon. I mean, I know there was a program, what was it, Golden Spike, the Golden Spike program.
Yeah, with Alan, and, what's his name?
Yeah, and, you know,
Alan
that's, I go to their Twitter site and their website every once in a while, and it really hasn't been too active over the past year or so. So I'm wondering what's going on, you know, and probably a lot of that has to do with funding and things like that. Although I'd really like to have an update of what's going on with that. Not just for personal curiosity, but also make a great addition to my letter, for that matter, a great thing to put in there as well. I'm actually might query them for the issue at the end of the year, on that. But yeah, I really see public-private partnerships being the wave of the future. There will be some commercial ventures, but I don't see purely commercial ventures doing it because I don't think at this point the money is really, the profit potential is actually there to justify it.
Listeners, we're coming up on the conventional end of the program today. If you do want to contact Michael via email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And there's still time for you to do that. And if you want to use the toll-free line and you have a decent phone line, the number is 1-866-687-7223. And there is still time for us to receive your call. Anything that you're seeing of interest from ESA in terms of some of the things we've been talking about, the moon, you know, humans, property rights, anything like that? Does ESA have anything interesting in that area?
They, from what I understand, they really haven't weighed in on the property rights thing, but ESA isn't going to, you know, if ESA goes to the moon, isn't going to be by themselves. They're more into partnerships. Right now they're starting to get cozy with China, you know, and they're really planning on being a, quote, partner in the Chinese space station. But at the same time, they're a partner, you know, the question is how long, you know, they're going to commit to the International Space Station, say, beyond 2024, and I'm kind of thinking they'll stick around until at least 2024 for that. I know Senator Ted Cruz, one of the things he put in this latest NASA Authorization Act was to facilitate a study to, you know, study actually extending the life of the space station to at least 2028. So ESA and Europe in general are looking to, are partnering with the Russians and China a lot. But I think they're going to hedge their bets and, you know, kind of stick with the U.S. a little bit, too, kind of mix it up a little bit. That way, if things go sour with the Russians or the Chinese, at least they'll have a fallback position with having a partner with the U.S. That's just kind of my gut assessment on where it's going there. Another interesting thing that domestically is Georgia's what we call the Georgia Space Flight Act, and that's kind of got stuck in the political mud in their Senate, and it's stuck into a Senate committee, and chances are it's going to have to be refiled at the beginning of the year. Essentially, what the Georgia Space Flight Act does is it creates a limited liability law for space flight participants and for operators. Basically, the same thing that New Mexico has and Virginia has and Florida and Texas. Basically, that is what they have put up there. They want to the idea is they want to build a spaceport, and but they know to attract commercial operators or have any chance of attracting commercial operators, they've got to have some sort of limited liability law. And I know Alabama is also has a bill in their Senate that would form a committee that would explore the potential of creating a spaceport in Alabama. So I mean, these things are these things are popping up in the state, in a lot of the states. I haven't heard anything in New Hampshire. I don't expect anything to happen in New Hampshire on the space front. I mean, as far as New Hampshire is concerned, the only thing we're interested in space is making sure our satellite and cable TV works, and our GPS and stuff. So.
Well, it'd be nice if there was some commercial business for all these proposed spaceports, but
well, that's a big thing, and that kind of brings me on to the UK spaceport situation. I mean, back a few months ago, it was really funny. I was talking with a mutual friend of ours, Chris Newman.
Uh-huh.
We were talking back and forth about the and basically what it was. It was almost going to be like the government was going to bid out proposals for a spaceport. And over the course of a weekend, that whole thing got dropped. And, we were talking back and forth with colleagues. My thing was, well, maybe they looked at what's going on in New Mexico, with that thing just basically sitting out there. And maybe they're thinking, well, maybe this isn't such a hot idea. Maybe we ought to study it a little bit more. I'm not sure what's going on right now. I got to do a little bit more studying. I haven't written about it for this issue of the Pressy, but I will have something for certain, for the fourth quarter issue at the end of December on what's going on with that. And of course, my own spin on it as well. Speaking of Spaceport America, Virgin Galactic got a launch license, for Spaceship Two. This is very interesting. Essentially, there are two basic types of licenses. There is an experimental license. There's an operating a launch license for operators, and a launch and reentry license for conventional rockets like ULA's Atlas V and such. Well, what happened with Spaceship One? They had an experimental license. In other words, under that license, it was strictly to prove out the technology, so that they could then get an operator's license and fly, do revenue generating flights. Under the experimental license, you can't do any revenue generating. Well, this time around, they actually, and I think I talked about this a few weeks on an open line show, the FAA gave them an operator's license. So basically what the FAA said, we will allow you to carry scientific payloads or cargo while you're test flying the vehicle and proving it out. But they expressly stipulated in it they could not have any spaceflight participants on board during flight operations until they meet certain criteria and prove certain things to the FAA. So I thought that was extremely significant, because that told me, wow, the FAA is really trying to be proactive and flexible with these groups to get them flying. But it works out great for Virgin Galactic, because they can go back to their investors and say, see, we have a positive cash flow even though we can't fly spaceflight participants. And they can go to Spaceport America, the New Mexico Authority, and say, you know what, we're actually making money now, so we can pay our rent, and we can actually say that we're flying revenue generating flights out of here, even though we're still proving out our vehicle. So it was an extremely significant development, and it really impressed me, and I'm all for it. I think it's great.
This may be the last question of the day, unless somebody else pops in real quick. Carl is in Tucson. He has a two-pointer for you, okay?
Sure.
Number one, do you think the next president will terminate the Wolf Amendment that prevents NASA from talking to China? Number two, I have been reading some news reports, but not widespread news reports, that the Chinese space station is heading out of control and will come back to Earth soon. I seem to have trouble confirming this, even though I have read it in some respectable newspapers online. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, well, to answer your first question, it's not as simple as whether a president can over... One, it's going to depend on what the president. If Mr. Trump becomes president, he's not going to be in favor of cooperating with space with the Chinese, because he's going to be very focused on national prestige, and he's going to be very suspicious of them, stealing technology and whatnot. If Mrs. Clinton becomes president, she would be in favor of cooperation with China, because that would spill onto a globalist mentality of, you know, the United States being part of the world instead of, you know, being, you know, on its own. The kicker is whether or not who controls the Senate and who controls Congress. At this point, it looks like the Republicans are going to hold the House of Representatives, and right now the way the polls are going, it looks like they may actually hold on to the Senate as well. If they hold on to the Senate, they're going to have enough juice to basically tell NASA you can't cooperate with China, regardless of who becomes president. So really, it isn't so much about who's the president, but it's about who controls both house, both the Senate and the House, because the Wolf Amendment comes out from that representative, and the Congress is using their power over NASA through the power of the purse to say you're not going to do it. Second, we're talking about Tiangong-1, which was actually launched in 2011. The Chinese have been really cagey about that. They finally admitted they're not controlling it. They're not controlling.
It's out of control. Yeah.
They don't have control of it, which basically says it's out of control, and it's not going to be a controlled reentry. They've been extremely cagey about it. It's going to come down sometime in 2017. We don't know when, but the new Space Control Squadron obviously is going to keep an eye on things, and they'll have a good idea where it comes down. Why is this important? Well,
whoa. What is the new Space Control Squadron?
Probably should have mentioned this, but back in I think it was in July, we're all familiar with the Joint Space Operations Center. They're the ones who give all these, you know, updates and warnings of possible intersections in orbit and put out these reports to the public and to, you know, other countries. They no longer do that. I think it's the 17th Space Control Wing now assume authority for that. They are the ones who put out these reports. Now, from what I understand, the Joint Space Operations Center and U.S. STRATCOM still controls the assets, but this control squadron actually is tapped into that, and they're the ones who fulfill that role of actually, you know, putting out these advisories to the public and to other countries under the agreements that we have.
Okay. So
that's a development.
All right. So it's out of control or not being controlled, coming in 2017,
right.
and so they're going to track it, but they can't control or guide it.
No, but they can have a good idea where it's going to go down. Now, the way its orbit is, chances are it's probably going to end up in one of the oceans, so it may not be a problem. But there's also a possibility that baby could, you know, reenter and part of it could survive and hit land. Well, the question is, where does it hit? If it hits in another country that belongs to this thing we call the Liability Convention and it causes damage, under that, the Chinese are a part of that treaty, they could be held liable, strictly liable, for any damage it caused. Now, I talk about this, again, I keep on going back to my letter, but, I mean, this thing I talk about in this letter. One of the concerns is, you know, if they do get on the hook for damage, will they honor the claim, or will they try and use their political clout or what we call soft political power to try to get out of that responsibility? Again, it's just an analysis of what could happen, you know, if this thing actually impacts land and causes damage, that, you know, compensational damage to land. So it's something to watch. In fact, it's in my section called What to Watch for 2017. So.
And it's too early to have a predictive orbit of where it's going to come in.
It's too early to have a predictive orbit. They're not going to be able to get an approximate area where it's going to land until right up to a few hours. And even that'll be speculative where it goes. So if they don't find any debris from it, chances are it'll end up in the ocean. If they do find a debris on land, well, if it's in a foreign country that signed on to the Liability Convention, they may have to deal with China's diplomatic organs to, you know, write a check or something like that for any damage that's caused.
So they haven't paid any damages on their ASAT stuff and on their collision and other things. So I don't think they have a great trust track record that they would, you know, pay any damages if they came down on a third party.
Well, there's customary law. There's two different types of liability under the Liability Convention. If something falls on land and causes damage, it's strict liability. if something happens in orbit, it's a fault-based comparison that that nobody quite knows how to work out. So, I mean, nobody can really, it's hard to really make, you gotta be able to prove it for one thing, and, that's kind of hard to do with the remains of their ASAT test. So that's kind of a legal thorn that nobody's really sat down and figured out. And there's going to be a lot of politics involved. So it's just a matter of, you know what, it's not even worth bothering with, you know, trying to get some money from, just because it is what it is. Unless you can absolutely prove that, you know, a piece of that wreckage actually damaged a satellite or the space station or something like that, and actually physically say, you know, show them here's the piece that did it, and we tracked it back to you. Or you know, find a made in China label on it or something like that.
So it's easier to nail them and hold them responsible for I lost my train of thought because the cell phone was going to ring. It's easier to hold them accountable if it actually comes down on land and does some damage.
Yeah, well, that happened back in 1975 with Cosmos 954, which is a nuclear powered reconnaissance satellite. It re-entered, and part of the reactor survived.
Yeah, I know.
Normally what happens with these things is before they re-enter, the reactor separates and is boosted into a higher orbit. Well, with this one, it didn't happen because the satellite was malfunctioning, and it spread radioactive debris all over the Northwest Territories of Canada. Canada went in, basically had to do some cleanup, and they got some of the parts, and they went to the ambassador for the Soviet Union at the time for Canada and said, you know, your satellite caused damage, we're making a claim under the liability convention. The Soviets denied it for saying, well, it really isn't a space object. You know, it really isn't a satellite. It's just a piece of a satellite, and they tried to get out of it. But eventually they said, yeah, it's a piece of our satellite. And they came to a settlement of, like $3 million at the time. But I think less than a quarter of that was actually paid, even if that. So there is some precedent for that strict liability standard under Article 2 of the Liability Convention, but there's no precedent for a claim under the Article 3 for the fault liability for something that happens in orbit.
Anything else you want to tell us about, or have we reached the end of your mental stamina period?
Oh, boy. We talked about a lot. One thing I would like to bring up is, you know, I think I talked about this a little bit on Open Lines, is the RD-180 issue. A few months ago, Senator Nelson brokered a deal as part of the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act that allows ULA to purchase 18 more engines to get them to the transition period for their next generation launch vehicle, the Vulcan. That was a big win for ULA, and I think for national security and the Atlas V for that matter. One of the things that's been rolling around in everybody's head is if Senator McCain, you know, whether when the next National Defense Authorization Act comes in, will Senator McCain honor that deal, or will, you know, he try to derail it and start this thing all over again? And a lot of it depends on whether he gets reelected. He's up for reelection this year, and the press is actually talking about this. And, you know, basically, you know, it looks right now like he won his primary challenge, and it's looking pretty good that he's going to retain his seat. So if he retains a seat and the Republicans actually hold on to the Senate, he'll retain his chairmanship, and that would leave him in a position to actually, you know, try and, you know, actually stir this up again in a future National Defense Authorization Act. So it's kind of a wait. The press is kind of waiting and seeing what happens in this next election period before it makes further procrastinations about it.
Well, I would think, depending on the final outcome of the SpaceX investigation and all of that, that they may want to, you know, keep these engines and the Atlas around for national security. I know ULA has said they ought to delay the bid because of the SpaceX accident. So that may enter into it. You never know.
Well, yeah, they're also doing it, but there was also kind of a veiled threat that they would challenge an award of upcoming contracts if those awards were based solely on cost. And I kind of predict when I wrote that special issue of the Pressy, that was one of my predictions. that ULA would use this as LEB would take advantage of this and use that leverage to actually get these contracts to contain more, to be based on more than cost. Because right now the way that these contracts, these competitions for national security launches are structured is based strictly on cost. And SpaceX is going to beat them hands down every time. ULA is coming in saying, look, there's more to this than cost. You know, there's reliability. We have a proven track record of, like, 111 launches. Some of that's, you know, we want that to be taken into consideration. Chances are they're using my analysis is they're using this latest incident to use that as leverage to lobby for these, for different, more criteria to be put into these competitions than just cost. So, and that would be a very smart thing for them to do. And I'm sure that's something their lobbyists, are pushing very heavily on the Hill right now.
Any closing comments for us?
Just to say that, you know, there's a lot popping right now in space law and policy. I notice it a lot more now that I've started this new publication. In fact, I mean, I'm looking, you know, just going through this. I had to basically whittle down what I was going to put in and what I wasn't going to put into this issue that's coming out on Friday. Again, I'll just ask you, go to the site and request a free issue of the Pressy, and I'll send it to you. You can look at it and see if it's for you. If it's for you, and if you decide it's for you, and you want to, you know, spend the money for a year subscription, I encourage you to do so. It comes right to your email, and it's going to be the medium for a lot of my in-depth thought about, you know, space policy and such. And I'm going to be doing a lot less writing in publications like Space News and the Space Review, and focusing a lot more on putting the content in for my subscribers to the Pressy.
Okay. Michael, listen, thank you for coming back on the show. And
hey, you're welcome, David. Always a pleasure.
We will talk to you before the end of the year. I'm going to change your date, by the way. I'll send you an email about it. I'm going to be out of town the Sunday that you chose. So
okay.
We need to reschedule that, but I'll get you a note in the next day or so.
And, okay, sounds good, David.
Listeners, thanks again. Bob Zimmerman is back tomorrow night on the space show. That should get some feathers ruffled, so tune in for that. And let's see, Europa is the subject of Hotel Mars. It is the subject of the Friday space show. Casey Dreyer of the Planetary Society is going to do Europa on both Hotel Mars and the space show. And on Sunday is Open Lines, and I am sure all of you will want to talk and opine on the Musk speech, which will be televised live tomorrow, so don't miss it. I'm sure you'll be able to find the link to watch it. It's all over the place. Special thanks to Michael and to all of you who have called and participated on the space show today. We appreciate it. Everybody have a great week coming up, and keep looking up. Goodbye from the space show.